FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right on Radio, David Fettig talks with Shauna Compton. She is the author of the new poetry collection, Creature Sounds Fade from Black Lawrence Press, and three other poetry collections. Her poems have appeared in The Nation, The American Poetry Review, McSweeney's, and a host of other publications. Shauna is the founding author of Bloof Books and is also a freelance book designer.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Liz Olds talks with award-winning author Kelly Bowen. She grew up in Manitoba, Canada, and worked as a research scientist and a veterinarian before realizing her dream of writing historical fiction. Currently, she lives in Winnipeg with her husband and two sons. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hi, Shauna.
Hi, David. I can't see you.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shauna, before we get started, we love to have our poets on here, and especially from a Black Lawrence Press. I'm going to ask you about a particular author whom you note in the notes, whom we've had on our program before, but we'll talk about that later in your note section. Anyway, so before we get started with a reading, Shauna, why don't you tell us a little bit about your relationship to poetry, if you would, please. By that, I mean when you started writing it or reading it, who you like to read and that sort of thing.
The first time I remember having anything to do with poetry was in about third grade. I had a teacher who assigned us to write a poem during class, and I didn't want to do it. And I was sent over to the side of the room.
Oh, no.
Being pretty pouty about it. And I ended up writing what I saw in front of me, a poem about a sailboat. On which I'd never been on a sailboat. I lived in the middle of Texas.
Okay.
There was a picture of a sailboat on the side of the reading exercise box that was in front of me on the desk. Wow. And I wrote the poem about that. And, I think she liked it. And we did a little zine of poems for the class. And some of the students drew pictures. And we all wrote poems. And we sold it to our parents as a fundraiser for the school or whatever. And, after that, I was a lot less reluctant, and I wrote poems, and I don't think I ever stopped after that.
I love that. I'm glad I asked you. That's a great story. That's amazing. So who do you like to read?
I read a wide variety of things. I mean, I read a lot of poetry, obviously, but because I work as a book designer, I'm always reading all kinds of things. It's hard sometimes for me to have conversations about what's current, because I'm always reading at least a year or two ahead because I'm working on things that haven't come out yet.
Cool.
But I do a lot of children's books. I read a lot of poetry. I like nonfiction. I love novels.
Fantastic.
It's hard to get specific, but.
Sure. Well, I want to talk to you about your designing too, but let's start with a reading now, if you don't mind. Do you have a particular poem you'd like to share with us?
I'm not going to read the first poem in the book because I've made a film of it and you can hear me reading that one online. It's already everywhere. So
okay,
I'm going to read the second poem of the book called Names for Storms.
Okay. So before you do that, so you made a film of The Eyes Have Woods. Would that be at shaunacompton.com, I'm guessing, or is that somewhere else we can find
it? I think it's somewhere on shaunacompton.com. It's also on the publisher website. If you go to blacklawrence.com and on my book page, it's at the top of the page there. And it's somewhere on Vimeo. I only have one video on my channel, but I have a channel there.
Okay, listeners, you heard
it. So it's
on
there.
Go out there and do a search for that. Okay, go ahead, please, Shauna.
This one's Names for Storms. I can't hear myself for the howling several dozen states away, the wadding stuffed under the cap of the decade. It's true. I can't see my hand in front of my face because it's clutching a stone in my left pocket. An image of a windsock at once fiercely and feebly orange. The darkening palpable. At the first pelted drops, we smell the charge in the air. The same moment we detect the quiver in the skin of the dog at our feet. The backs of our thighs embossed a plush pattern of flowers ganged up on the threadbare armchair. The bursting of glass at each window, successive, percussive, A silence eeries between the booms of tossed trash cans in the street, the crack of a twig-snapped pole, the fizz of the downed wires, the television already lifting its heavy feet.
That's Shanna Compton reading from her new collection, Creature Sounds Fade. That's a great poem to start with, Shanna, because I think there's a lot we could talk about. In part, let's begin just with the title of your collection, Creature Sounds Fade, and it's in parens. And as you read this poem, we encountered sounds which are denoted by parens and large caps and that sort of thing. Tell us what you were thinking when, without giving away too much, because the reader's supposed to have the experience of making sense of
things. I mean, it's okay to talk about the conceit of the captions. They're closed captions. I started losing my hearing when I was in my 20s due to a genetic hearing loss. We don't really know what it is. My sister has the same thing. Huh. And as my hearing started to fade, I didn't notice. It wasn't very dramatic at first. And I got less and less from the world around me. And the closed captions are my attempt to bring focus back to some of the sounds I had lost that I regained when I started using hearing aids and other assistive technologies. So while I can't say that I'm deaf per se, not technically, I am definitely hard of hearing and it definitely impacts my daily life. And as a poet, we know how important our ears are to us and the sounds of the words and the voices of the poets that we listen to and that we hear in our heads when we're reading are very important. And the sounds of nature are very important to me. Mm. And all of those things started to go. And as I kind of came back to the world of better hearing, once I got the hearing aids and you know, had talked to my audiologist, the little nonverbal sounds that I had been missing took on a great importance for me. Mm. I realized how much they conveyed about the situation that I was in, about the environment that I was in, how they helped me orient myself in a room, for instance, or out in the woods where I was hiking, or, you know, it's very easy to startle someone who can't hear you coming. So as I was writing these poems, I didn't start out having that as a theme, but I was writing them around the same time as I was kind of coming to terms with that and getting some of my hearing back through these technologies. And it just became a part of the way I notice. And so I want the reader to notice those little sounds that are here represented, you know, with words printed on a page,
right,
or my voice when I read them. But I want to give them extra emphasis by making them bigger than they really are, by showing them as closed captions would be if you're watching a movie with the captions on or something like that.
Well, it's very effective. I'm a little bit chagrined that I didn't pick that up, that it's a closed captioning technique. Not ashamed.
I don't think it says anywhere in the book. No. So,
but once you say it makes perfect sense. I thought it was a great technique to, of course, as you just described, highlight those sounds, and you can't help hearing them as you're reading the poems, much more than you would otherwise if they were not in parens and not in caps and so on. Very, very effective. Creature sounds. Nature is in these poems, and you hinted at this, but yet there's some great human moments in here too. So what's your relationship, and you hinted at this in your last question, but what's your relationship with nature and how you intentionally brought nature and animals and that sort of thing into these poems?
The original title for the book, or the working title before I landed on this one, was Fellow Animals, because I was sort of seeing myself as part of the nature around me and as an animal, as a creature myself, mm-hmm. As a living thing, I think I turn into a fungus in one of the poems. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the environment and my connection to it.
Yeah.
And the way the sounds sort of provide that sort of connective tissue. And the way I was growing it back, maybe a little too literal, but I was thinking about all those things. And I spend a lot of time outside hiking and walking and live on a river. So all of that's all around me all the time. I moved away from New York City several years ago. And while it's still definitely part of my poetics and psyche, the time that I spent there, it's I didn't grow up in a city and I don't live in one now. So, you know, if I'm in a field or surrounded by trees, I feel more like myself.
So you are the narrator. This is your point of view. For some poems, some poets, it's very safe and easy to assume that that's the poet's voice that we're hearing. But it wasn't always clear to me that was the case. Like maybe you were channeling someone or something else, and that's to your credit. Is Shanna's voice in all of these poems, or are you playing around with that?
I was talking with my spouse about that earlier. I think these more so than some of the earlier books where I had a lot of characters speaking. It's difficult for me sometimes as a poet to confront myself very directly. So I do often have speakers who are not me. Mm-hmm. But in this one, it turns out that because I was paying such close attention to my personal experience as I was writing the poems, they ended up mostly being spoken by someone who, if not me, is very like me.
Right, that right. Makes sense. I wonder if we could take a look at 20 Motels, a particular poem.
Sure.
47. I'm sure you have it memorized.
Thank you. I was like, what page is that one? I don't have the memorized.
And if you wouldn't mind reading it, there are so many wonderful lines in here. I don't know that everyone reads poetry. And of course, we think they should. once in a while, at least. But if you could read this, then maybe we'll talk a little bit about it in some of these lines. Poetry is a pleasure to read, even if you end the poem and you're not really sure what you just read. But if you've heard something or felt something along the way, it made you stop and think. That's good enough, as far as I'm concerned. It's a bit of a meditation. At any rate, so 20 Motels, if you wouldn't mind, please.
Sure, 20 Motels. In the first motel, we ditched our parents. In the second one, we got caught. After a dozen, I remember a green one, flickering like a stripe on the highway. We blinked and passed. In the 15th motel, I slept alone, but the bed was crowded with grief. And another halfway between two borders, north and south, three languages, and every line transgressed. Each motel, the set of a terrible play. The motel with stairs inside, so a hotel, really. The small squarish bed we laughed about, the sketch I made of you on the bus. The motel just far enough away where the ice from the plastic bucket turned to runnels along our skins. The one with the pool at which all the lights ached and I existed as a cabinet amid a family, my sticky hinge. Every circular driveway uncanny and familiar, culminating in the handing over of a key. The scent when you enter each room, the odor when you leave it, the perpetual abandonment of perpetuity. Each room breathing like the spaces left in a loaded sentence. On each borrowed bed, a suspect pillow to which you can only succumb.
Thank you. 20 Motels, Shanna Compton. I love this poem. I don't know how most of us can relate to all or most of this poem. For your literal description of motels along the way, but phrases like, but the bed was crowded with grief, the one with the pool at which all the lights ached. There's something about a motel pool lighting, which, it's really depressing, I think. Anyway, the scent when you enter each room, the odor when you leave it, and so on. Where did this poem come from?
I don't think there are actually 20 motels in the poem. I've never counted
correct.
Them, but I don't think I have.
I did.
But,
that's who I am.
I don't know how many there are. I don't, sometimes the way the title relates to the poem is not, very direct, but I started out writing, probably some of the first phrases in the poems. And then I just sort of let the associations of one road trip and motel stop take me to the next. And so it becomes in the poem almost like it's one long trip, mm-hmm. but it was actually several. But when you think about that, and when you turn it into a poem, you sort of realize how all of those experiences are always linked, even though they take place over many years and with different people and different countries and different times and places. It does kind of, there's a continuity that forms underneath them when you look at them as the same kind of experience in the same kind of place. And like you said, the lights in the pool area at a motel, roadside motel somewhere at night, aren't very beautiful, but there is something special about them in the sense
haunting.
They're unlike other places. And so that's the kind of feeling I was going for in the poem.
And I love this. On each borrowed bed, a suspect pillow. If we all don't think of that phrase the next time we stay in a hotel or a motel, a borrowed bed, I've never thought of a hotel or a motel bed as borrowed, but it is, and a suspect pillow indeed, that's for sure. And a bit of humor in here, the motel with stairs inside, so a hotel, really. Is that the definition? I've always wondered.
I mean, it seemed to me to be a definition when I was writing. I sort of made fun of myself.
I'm going to go with it. I'm going to quote you on it. But let's stay with this poem and talk about form. Listeners could hear you breaking at various points, but you weren't breaking at the end of the line necessarily. You were breaking within lines. One of your form techniques, if you will, or models, is to break the line in the middle, like a lot of space on the same line between words. I'm not describing this well. You're the designer, Shanna. Why don't you describe for us what these poems look like and why you chose this particular form? Because it's throughout the book.
It's something that came up a lot when I was writing the poems in this book that I hadn't really used before, but other poets have used it. C.B. Wright uses it a lot. In my case, I use it as a form of punctuation almost. Gap, that's what I call it, a gap in the line. Okay. It's usually 8 or 9 spaces. And it's just enough to separate one part of the line from the other so they feel different yet still connected. They're on the same line.
Right.
So you do sometimes hear me pause or kind of pronounce the gap a little bit. It's a little bit stronger than a comma, but it's also sometimes an intuitive leap. And so you may not hear it. I haven't actually studied very closely the way I read the poems versus what's on the page. To me, they all make sense, but they may not all be doing exactly the same thing. It's either a pause in the sound in my mind, or it's me making a little bit of a leap from one part of the line to the next.
Okay. So, yeah, I love having these conversations with poets about the shape that poems take, because they really do. As a designer, do you see the poem on the page? Is that important to you, what it looks like?
It's very important what it looks like. I used to write everything longhand back in the day, you know, before we had so many easy keyboards, like in all of our pockets.
I remember that.
But I don't do that anymore. I definitely typically write on my computer or on my iPad. And then what comes later, the way the poem kind of flows out, I do tend, because I've been doing this for such a long time now, to have an organizing principle that I kind of let organize things as it's coming out. So whether it's couplets or triplets or quatrains or these gaps, or I'll have a couple of words that I want to use X number of times, and I'll just keep playing with the phrase until I get that word in 3 or 4 times, whatever, or a sound. It doesn't have to be a word. So I play, they're not formalist poems in a traditional sense, but right. I do play sort of style games and sound games, and formal linkages are important to me. And they help me sort of move the poem along in a way that the logic of the poem and me just sitting in the chair thinking doesn't. It kind of frees me up to go along where the poem is taking me.
Yeah, interesting.
By being very mechanical. And part of that is the way they look. And I'm very particular about the font, the typeface that I write in, and all that stuff. I can't write in a sans serif. I love sans serif typefaces, but I don't like them for poetry or for body text.
Okay.
So I always write in a serif font, and the gaps are important. I want lots of white space when I'm writing, so I tend to put things in the middle of my screen and shut everything else out. And then as I get to the revision stage, I actually type everything up on a manual typewriter, which is a whole different experience.
Wow.
It takes the speed and ease out of the computer sort of transactions. So then later they tend to change shape when I look at them in a more analog format. If that makes sense, like way the computer makes everything easy to move around, the manual typewriter does not.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I have to be more deliberate. Yeah, it's a different process.
You can't say the word font. There's probably font geeks listening right now and some in the studio. What's your favorite font? Go on.
I have many that I use for lots of reasons, but okay. I think this is an Adobe Chasm Pro.
Oh, hey, thumbs up from Josh.
Yeah.
Yep. He made
it's a classic book font. It's, you know.
It's a classic. I thought Baskerville was one too, but anyway, I like that. I like Baskerville.
Baskerville is beautiful.
Okay. Thank you. How about another poem? Because we're getting dangerously close to this, the end of our conversation already, and we need to hear poetry from you.
Sure. Let's see.
I've marked a number of them, but you go ahead and.
Oh, if you have a request, I'll be happy to do it.
Oh, gosh. I've got Misnomer on page 55. I don't remember why I marked that down. So hopefully there's, you know, nothing we can't say on the radio because those tend to appeal to me, Shanna.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I'll skip it if so. Okay. This is Misnomer. Misnomer. I couldn't write today in the face of that bomb, which makes me wonder how we ever can, but talking to ourselves and each other in poems is a manner of coping. When I am angry that poems do nothing, I am angry, and poems do appear to hold it. I run over the brim of the bowl. I hold my arms out to the trashed earth and all its frightened and ferocious people. I make no space for that man here who means biggest, best, most fantastic, most lethal when he says mother. But he grabs my space nevertheless. Headlines, airtime, theoretical lives. He doesn't bother to imagine. Spreadsheets full of numbers. Numbers full of awful profit. I'm awful as a prophet. But I know poems will burst from us. Nevertheless. Know that Moab was both brother and son to his mother, whose mother turned back for a final look at the burning world. Maybe she is the mother meant. Mother of bombs. Mother of brother sons, daughter mother of a lot of woe,
yeah.
Who burst as we burst, our dams, our horror, our burst in air. Yeah, I skipped the F-bomb there for you.
And we got a Moab mention, and that's always a highlight.
We did.
So thank you for that. That's Misnomer by Shanna Compton. When I'm angry that poems do nothing, I am angry, and poems do appear to hold it. You're deep into the book world. You have you look like a very cool person. All the books in your background there. We're looking at her in Zoom, ladies and gentlemen. And how has poetry fared during COVID, Shanna? You're in the book world. Is it more relevant for people? What do you think?
I do think I saw, especially in the beginning, a lot of people sharing poems about the situation, the loneliness and the isolation and the disconnectedness. And I saw a lot of people writing about it too. A lot of my poet friends were sort of addressing the daily reality and how different it suddenly was. And it seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. One thing that I do with some friends every year is write a poem every day in the month of April. And that happened last year, right after we all got locked down. And so all of our poems were dealing with this on a daily basis, you know. And what happens when you're writing every day is what's right in front of you comes in. And so there was a lot of that. And I do think I saw people sharing new poems, old poems, going back to favorites. And the act of connecting with somebody by, you know, posting a page from a book you're reading on Instagram and having people respond to it was because we lost being able to do that in person. All of our readings were canceled. All of the poetry events that we typically go to and see each other and read at were all canceled. And, you know, until just recently, I wasn't even acclimated to Zoom. So I wasn't even doing any of that.
Oh, wow.
And we were missing that. And so I think I did see extra sharing of poems. Small presses and poetry presses throughout the pandemic have not fared all that well, to be totally honest. Like financially, it's always tough. But, you know, people were sort of hunkering down and you know, a lot of people lost work and weren't spending as much money on books. And we'll just wait it out. But it's two different things, really.
Yeah. You have a notes section. You don't often encounter that in a poetry book, but it's pretty cool. And you mentioned Becca Claver, and we have had her on the show. I just need to you know, shout out to Becca. I'm sure she's listening somewhere.
Yeah, Bex is great. One of my favorites.
Okay, very good. We're nearing the end here. What are you working on next? And when can we expect to hear from you again?
I've been working off and on a long narrative poem that's gone through several titles, and it's currently been put aside because the pandemic made it not what I wanted to write. It's about a woman, a young woman, wandering alone through a blighted landscape. So it didn't seem like,
well, that's just like what we need.
I will return to it, but it didn't seem like a thing that I should be spending most of my days doing when I was already locked down without company. So
I look forward to that. I hope you let us know. White Chrysanthemum, a nice long poem in this collection, ladies and gentlemen, is really a special poem and worth it, worth the price of admission right there. Shanna Compton, author of Creature Sounds Fade, a poetry collection from Black Lawrence Press. What a treat to have you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Great. And now this.
Kelly, are you there?
I sure am.
Oh, great. I can hear you and everything. Well, some of our headphones don't work. We're a small radio station. We're speaking with Kelly Bowen, author of The Paris Apartment. And why don't you start with giving us a little synopsis of the book, no spoilers, and do a reading from it.
This sounds great. Okay, I will do my best to not put any spoilers in this. This book is a dual narrative, so it has both a past and present timeline. The past timeline being set during World War II, and the present narrative that starts in present-day Paris with Leah, who has inherited an apartment from her grandmother, whom she knows. Nobody in her family knew anything about this apartment. She never knew it existed. And when she walks into this apartment, she finds this apartment hasn't been touched in decades and decades. And as she walks into this apartment, she finds a lot of art, lots and lots of art, and also some things in the apartment that makes her think that perhaps the art perhaps was not acquired in a good way. She thinks that the art may have been stolen during the occupation of Paris. One of the paintings that she comes across is a small, obscure painting, and that painting leads her to an art restorer, Gabriel Seymour. And together, they start to try and piece together the mystery of this abandoned apartment and the art that's found in it. And what they find is that their families actually have reconnected in the past and crisscrossed through history. And at the end, they discover the legacy that past has left behind. And I will read just a short snippet here from the first chapter, and I'll preface it by saying that Leah has entered this apartment that she's known nothing about. She is starting to think that her grandmother was someone else that she never knew. So here we go. Leah tore her gaze from the paintings and continued through the dining room, stepping into a hallway. On her right, a doorway opened up into a kitchen with a tiny stove, a small refrigerator, and a deep sink set into a countertop free of clutter, save for a single crystal tumbler. Just to her left, a set of French doors stood open, the dim outline of a four-poster bed identifying this last space as a bedroom. As in the living room, lights of sunlight from tall windows were visible on the far wall. Leah entered the room, skirted the bed, and with a great deal more care than she had taken earlier, eased the heavy curtains open. In the light, the room was a decidedly feminine space, the walls papered in a shade of rose, the edges near the ceiling only slightly yellowed and discolored. The room consisted of a double bed, a dressing table and a chair, and an enormous wardrobe, all carved with a provincial flair. The bed was neatly made, and the linens, once washed, would likely be the same rose hue as the walls. The room was impeccably tidy, save for a garment that had been tossed carelessly on top of the smooth coverlet, crumpled and forgotten and dulled by dust. It was an evening gown, Leah realized, moving to lift it by its thin straps, a stunning creation of lemon-yellow chiffon and crepe, beaded with crystals and something that would have been obscenely expensive no matter what century it had been purchased in. Not something that one would toss aside like a pair of old socks. Bewildered, she let the dress drop back to the bed and eyed the narrow arched doorway in the corner beside the wardrobe. It led into what looked like a modern walk-in closet. A dressing room, Leah guessed, though there was almost no space to walk in. On both sides, dresses and gowns and furs and coats hung crammed together, spilling out on top of one another in such numbers that Leah couldn't even see the back wall. "Good heavens," Leah mumbled, the excess hard to comprehend. She backed away and cautiously opened the wardrobe next, expecting to be inundated with another jumble of extravagance. But the wardrobe was almost empty, the cavernous interior leading only a half dozen gowns. These gowns, protected from years of dust, were a collection of couture silks and satins, each one exquisitely embroidered, appliqué, and detailed. Leah ran her fingers along the length of a sapphire-colored skirt and pulled her hand back, afraid that she would soil the fabric. She closed the wardrobe and rested her forehead against the double doors. The gowns, the shoes, the furs, there was a fortune in clothing here, just like there was a fortune in fine furnishings and fine art, and all of it hidden for over 70 years. Leah lifted her head and took a steadying breath. Assumptions never ended well. A career dedicated to science had taught her that. She would give her grandmother the benefit of the doubt. She would not believe the worst until such time as she was presented with irrefutable proof. Feeling a little better, Leah headed back towards the bedroom doors, but stopped abruptly as she caught sight of her reflection. A little tarnished and spotted, the mirror mounted above the dressing table nonetheless revealed the troubled lines that still suffused Leah's features. Almost involuntarily, she sank onto the little chair, ignoring the dust, not taking her eyes off her reflection. Had her grandmother been the last to be reflected in this mirror? And if Leah could go back in time, what would she have seen? Whom would she have seen? Her eyes dropped back to the surface of the dressing table, a collection of decorative glass bottles huddled in the center. A pair of woman's gloves lay discarded beside them, abandoned where they had been dropped. Beside the gloves, propped up against the bottom of the mirror, was a small card. A postcard of some sort, Leah thought as she reached for it. It was a black-and-white photo of a long, looming building, a row of Roman columns lining the entire facade like an ancient temple. An impressive display of architecture, marred only by the Nazi flag snapping proudly in the wind in the foreground. Dread returned and manifested into something far more sinister. Very slowly, Leah turned the postcard over. "For the lovely Estelle," it read in scrawled faded ink, "with thanks, Hermann Göring." And I'll leave it there.
Okay, that's a good beginning. A nice start for the story. It sets it up very well. We're speaking with Kelly Bowen, author of The Paris Apartment. Now, I'm curious, in your bio, it says that you have also been a research scientist and a veterinarian. And I'm wondering, it said that your dream was to write historical fiction. Why was that a dream of yours?
I have always been an amateur historian from the time I was very, very young. Both my grandfathers served in the war, and my one grandfather in particular had a huge collection of books and maps and research material that was his own personal collection. When I was young, I would remember reading them probably when they were far over my head, but those books kind of captured my imagination, and that kind of interest in history followed me all the way through, even though I did do my degrees in science.
And why? Well, you sort of answered this question, but I just want to know, out of all the historical areas you could have dealt with, why World War II?
I find the conflict itself very interesting, probably driven mostly by my family's own experience in it. I also write historical romance as well as historical fiction in a different time period. But for historical fiction, absolutely, World War II is has always been an area of interest of mine. And I've loved writing since I was little, and it wasn't until I had my first child that I actually kind of had the time and sat down and started writing, I guess, for real, like with an intent to write and complete an entire novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, all writing is real, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm curious, in terms of the idea of the book, which came first to you, the knowledge of the pictures and then the story about World War II, or was it the story about World War II and you found the knowledge of the pictures in your research?
Probably a little bit of both. This story itself was inspired by the DeFlorian apartment that was found abandoned for a number of years in Paris, which was quite fascinating, but also specifically by the discovery of the Gurlitt Hoard in Munich, which was a huge art collection that was discovered. And so I guess to answer the question, that kind of got me... That was kind of the basis of the inspiration for that book. And then on top of that, the role of women in World War II has always been very, very interesting to me, and specifically how it differed very much on both the Eastern and Western fronts. So I worked that into the story as well.
Yes, I will want to talk about that in a moment. But first, I just want to talk about your research. I mean, you must have been... You must have done an incredible amount of research, and I have several questions. How much of it was primary sources, diaries and letters and so on?
When I do my research, I do try as much as possible. You can start with the history books, which give you dates and times and numbers, but I do try to, when I do my research, as much as possible, try to go to original sources, and in a lot of cases, because of the date and we're quite a bit past the conflict, that's memoirs or letters or diaries. So a good portion of my research is definitely based on memoirs. I love not only knowing what happened, but what that particular person who lived through it experienced, what they saw, what they felt, just kind of how they were thinking. I find that part just fascinating.
Yes, very fascinating. I love primary sources myself, although, you know, sometimes they're hard to find as well. Were there any particular books that you really enjoyed or that you would recommend to someone who was interested in learning more about, well, about this aspect of World War II, for example?
Absolutely. So my two characters, Sophie and Estelle, mainly Sophie, to some extent Estelle, that drive the past narrative, were based on SOE agents, so the first women that were sent into combat on the Western Front. And two of the books I enjoyed the most was Virginia Hall's memoirs, and it's called The Wolves at the Door by Judith Pearson, and that's a fascinating read. I definitely recommend that one. And the second one that I really, really enjoyed was Codename Pauline, and that was Pearl Witherington Cornelius' story, and that's edited by Catherine Atwood. So if you were looking for two memoirs of women in combat, the SOE agents that were dropped behind enemy lines, I would definitely recommend those two.
Were there women? I know in World War One there were women ambulance drivers, quite a lot of women ambulance drivers. Was that true in World War Two as well?
Yeah, so in World War II, I mean, women got involved right away, like immediately. But for the most part, specifically on the Western Front, they were in more of a supporting role. So they ferried the airplanes, but they weren't actually allowed to take those airplanes into combat. Or they provided, you know, they worked in factories, they worked in agriculture. They did so much kind of behind the scenes. Whereas on the Western Front, with the way that Russia was invaded, you had snipers and tank gunners and fighter pilots that were all women. Stalin used women much differently than the generals on the West did, and that kind of juxtaposition is quite interesting to me.
It seems to be. I remember. Was there a movie about a woman sniper, or what? Was it a book? This is completely,
Probably both. I've also have those memoirs. My favorite one is called Lady Death, and that's a memoir of Stalin Sniper, and that's one of my favorites. And also, there's a number of memoirs and books about the fighter pilots, specifically the Night Witches. which they dropped bombs on German targets. And they were all women. Lots of them were teenagers. They were sent up, no radar, none of the gadgets that we had, or even some of their male colleagues would have had. They were just absolute. They were heroes. They were so courageous. I can't even imagine reading some of their stories.
And what kind of difficulties did you have in the research and maybe the writing? I mean, this was a very emotional book to read, and I wonder about the difficulties of that as well as the research.
I don't say difficulties. The research, being kind of a historian, I love it. It's the one of the best parts of this job for sure. When I couldn't find something in a book or a memoir, I certainly reached out to historians who are far more knowledgeable and learned than myself. I reached out to Bletchley Park, reached out to the Monuments Men. David Kenyon was a big help in terms of the Lorenz cipher machines that is mentioned in this book, as part of this book. I'm not afraid to ask questions, that's for sure. There's so many people out there with so much incredible knowledge. And the writing itself, because this was a past narrative and a present narrative, I don't know if it was difficult, but it was certainly a challenge making sure when I switched in between the narratives that I didn't have any repetitive storytelling in my story, or I didn't jar the reader into the past and then back into the present. So it was a little bit, had to be a little bit careful with that. I don't know if it would be difficult, but definitely a challenge.
And why did you choose to go back and forth? I think you may have said this in your intro, but I'd like to revisit it. What made you choose to go back and forth as a form?
I liked the idea of the present day generation learning that, for Leah, that her grandmother was not who she thought she was, that her grandmother was actually a very different person years and years ago. I like the idea of them being able to kind of solve the mystery and learning about their family in the process and learning about the sacrifices people made in the past. And so that by the end when Leah is presented with the legacy that was left behind by her grandmother, the reader had a much better understanding of what cost it came at.
This is kind of a risky question because you may say, no, it's not. But I was reading your acknowledgments and you mentioned Josephine Baker, and I was wondering if that's the Josephine Baker, musician and vocalist.
The Josephine Baker of the Banana Outfit?
Yes.
Yes, that would be Josephine Baker, who I did a little spy work through her music. So she was a regular fixture at a number of the cabarets in Paris.
Right.
And she certainly did her part.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. That's fun to know. I'm kind of a blues old music aficionado, so Josephine Baker is one of my favorites. So,
She's fantastic. Yeah, she has a history. She wasn't all who she pretended to be, and she used it well.
Now, Shelley and Sophie and Estelle become friends fairly quickly. I mean, not instantly, but fairly quickly, and it made me think not just about them, but that in wars, it seems like people have to develop relationships pretty quickly. I mean, all the women that married their men right before they went off to war and so on. And I'm wondering if you use that in your story of Sophie and Estelle, or if it just sort of happened that way. I mean, did they become friends quickly in part because of the war itself?
Absolutely. I was thinking you kind of hit the nail on the head there. People did what they had to do with who they had to do it with, and they didn't they just made it work. And for Sophie and Estelle, in terms of who they were, Sophie being very learned, had aspirations, you know, into academia, was determined to do absolutely nothing that everybody expected of her. And then Estelle, on the other hand, who was supposedly the socialite, who, you know, was there to be pretty and entertaining and be a decoration. And she kind of, both of them chafed under the expectations. So two very different women from different worlds, but similar in that they were put into a box of expectations that they wanted nothing to do with. And I think that that's when they got together and developed that relationship. On the surface, they're very different people, but underneath that, they're very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they have. Yes, similar emotions, and Sophie's the ice princess, and Estelle is more the singer and cabaret kind of person. But they really do have a meeting of the minds, especially when they understand who each other
which
is.
Which probably never would have occurred if war hadn't have gotten in the way.
Right.
Their lives, probably their paths, never would have crossed. They were moving in different circles, so the war is what brought them together.
Now, what effect would you say the theft of the art had on people of the time, and what kind of effect it has now as we find them and try to find the owners, the rightful owners of the art?
So I used art in this book, number one, because I love art. I love art history. But I also used art for what it represented during this conflict. And my characters talk about it, too. And it's not, and of course, you can't ever equate a human life with a canvas or, you know, or a painting. But it's what that art represents. And that art represents entire families. It represents the history of those families. It represents the history of communities and of entire countries. And when that is stolen, and they talk about that in the book, it's like, what does that theft represent? It's stealing history from people, from countries, from families, stealing identities from those people. And one of the saddest things, if you peruse through the Monuments Man Foundation or dig a little bit deeper into that, is that lots of the auction houses now have employees whose sole job is to decide if a piece that's brought to auction, if there's any possible way that it could have been looted during the occupation of any of those countries that the Nazis occupied. And in lots of cases, when they identify a piece that was stolen, there is no one to return it to. Even if they can identify it, and even if they can identify who the rightful owners are, there is no family left to return it to. And that really struck me, that absolute loss of humanity.
That kind of comes up in relation to, is it Rachel is the name of Aviva's aunt? Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, got it right. I can't read my own handwriting, actually. That's part of what the problem is here. Anyway, talk some about Aviva. And also, I don't think I'm spoiling too much because this comes at the beginning of the book, but how she reacted to losing her parents in one of the, or her aunt and in one of the actions where they came in and took people out of their homes, and somehow the paintings got saved, I guess, the Degas stuff. But anyway, talk about Aviva. She's a very wonderful and character difficult.
So in the story, Aviva, who is a young Jewish girl, she represents quite a few people who went into hiding or escaped the deportations and the executions. There were so many people throughout France and other countries as well who worked hard to help those people escape. So for Aviva, she loses her family, and Estelle steps in to help. And I'm trying not to give too many spoilers here.
Yeah.
And there comes a time where Estelle knows that she has to do more. She has to do more for Aviva, that what she is doing isn't enough. And that comes at a very high kind of emotional price for Estelle, because she feels, in some way, she knows what she has to do, but she feels she's failing the promises that she made mm-hmm. to Aviva's family. But in the end, the legacy that's left behind through Aviva is what Leah gets to discover.
Yes, yes. Well, we are running out of time. We've been speaking with Kelly Bowen, author of The Paris Apartment. Wonderful, wonderful book. Very, very, very briefly, what's next?
What's next? I have another historical fiction that I am currently writing, and it will take place in the Netherlands and in France, also set in World War II. And it's going to center a little bit around the Dutch resistance, as well as the Jedburgh team sent ahead of Operation Overlord and Operation Market Garden.
Great. That sounds exciting, too. Thank you very much for coming on Right on Radio and talking about your book, The Paris Apartment. It's a wonderful book. I can highly recommend it.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure to be here.
Oh, great. Well, I'll let you go now. Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds, and I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Kelly Bowen and Shanna Compton, plus our listeners. Without you and your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast. Sorry, I can't see. Recently lost podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.